It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. As an emergency preparedness reporter, author and New York Times correspondent Sherry Fink has covered deadly hurricanes, effects of climate change, and even the more recent migrant crisis at the border. And she says they all have one thing in common. Disasters don't always create structural failure, but they can reveal them. She joined us a few days ago, just ahead of a trip to Pittsburgh. Sherry, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
For the readers among us, you're probably best known for your tome, 5 Days at Memorial. It's this gut-wrenching play-by-play of what happened at Memorial Hospital in New Orleans during and just following Hurricane Katrina. What struck me was just how relatable so many of these tiny, awful mistakes felt for the people in the moment. Can you tell us a little bit about the reporting process, both for your Pulitzer Prize-winning story and later the book?
Yeah, well, it lasted over a number of years. That's why it's a tome. And really what I wanted to do was to try to piece together from many, many accounts and documentary materials, whatever was existing, to try to go moment by moment through the experience of a hospital when a disaster strikes, like it could anywhere, and look at individual decision making. Because as we know, when a disaster hits, the official responders can't always get there right away. And so it's up to you and me and whoever's in the immediate vicinity of a disaster to make difficult decisions. And of course, when a hospital is hit or is in the midst of a big emergency, that's particularly difficult. So it was many years of talking to people and pulling together sort of evidence to piece together what happened in this very, very difficult situation.
And 5 Days came out some time ago. Remind us what happened at Memorial Hospital. What kind of facility was it? And what big mistakes were made that led you to this reporting project at all?
So Hurricane Katrina struck in 2005, and it wasn't the storm itself. It was the flooding, the failure of the levees that protect this, you know, such an iconic American city that really caused the problem. So the hospital, like many hospitals, was in an area that was below sea level. And they knew that once water rose to a certain level, they would lose power. Kind of striking, but many of our hospitals in flood-prone areas, and I know Pittsburgh also is prone to flooding from time to time, but many critical institutions aren't really, they don't have electrical systems that are protected. And so what happened was that the floodwaters rose, and there were two key decision-making points. One is, if you know you're about to lose power, which patients do you rescue first when you have hundreds of patients and you have to decide? And then the second crisis, which is what really drew journalists and also law enforcement officials to this particular hospital, was eventually the power did fail and people waited a few days for rescue and helicopters were coming slowly and boats were actually coming up to the emergency room ramp. But there were a group of patients, really the sickest of the sick, who the healthcare staff became very worried, would they be able to be rescued at all? And there was a, you know, talk of intentionally hastening their deaths, which is something that we don't typically or really ever do in modern American medicine. And so that became a real big area of debate. And a doctor and two nurses were arrested and accused of second-degree murder after the storm some months later. So the book really looks at what happened moment by moment that led people to be even so desperate, you know, really well-respected health professionals to even consider something like this. And then what was it that really happened? And how do you apply law to an extreme situation? Should we be held to the standards, the legal standards, the ethical standards that we would in normal times or not? Or is an extreme time a time where we need our professional ethics and our morals more than ever? So that's really a lot of what I'll be talking about and what the book 5 Days at Memorial and the story covered.
Yeah, I mean, they were dealing with life or death in the worst possible set of scenarios. But a lot of your reporting these days seems to follow that same through line, or at least emergency preparedness generally. How does what you learned during reporting 5 Days at Memorial inform what you write about today?
It informs it a lot. It sounds, what I've just outlined sounds like so extreme, but in fact, I've continued to cover mass disasters in the U.S., from mass shootings to the recent hurricanes, which seem to be coming more and more frequently and are more seem to be more and more severe, and even, you know, sort of like medical issues during the crisis at our southwest border. And I see some common themes, which is that often it's a question of how do we prioritize who gets access to potentially life-saving resources when it feels like there's not enough to go around. And often what we see is that the same groups that are most vulnerable on a day-to-day basis or most disadvantaged, that that just gets magnified when it comes to these more stressful emergency situations. And so a lot of what I write about has to do with some of those questions, and also to really make sure that when it comes to a crisis, that in fact we don't have these tragic deaths, and we don't have a sense coming out of it that there were major injustices.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and New York Times correspondent Sherry Fink. Sherry, I wonder, how do you think we in our communities prepare to take care of ourselves if or when the systems and institutions that we depend on day to day fail us in a time of emergency?
I think it's really incumbent on all of us to remember that emergency response isn't just about your first responders, your police, your fire, your ambulance crews, because when a disaster strikes, often, you know, there's just not enough of them to get there right away. And they really need us and in the general public to sort of do things that will help the outcomes. And I've seen this over and over again, that in the immediate response, like the immediate life-saving first few minutes of a crisis, it is the preparedness of the general public that really counts. And mass shootings is a great example where now the medical community is really urging all of us to learn things like basic techniques to stop bleeding. Because if you can do that, if you know how to put a tourniquet on or even just apply pressure on a wound, you can save a life. And that's just one example. But I think what I've learned is it's really important for us to sit back and sort of take a break from the daily pressures. And that's hard. We have lots of stresses, and our resources are often really tight in terms of how we spend our money and our time, but important to sit back as a household, as a family, as a community, and think about what are the most likely potential emergencies, and what can I do to be more prepared, and who in my community should I be looking out for, and you know, what are the resources that we have? It's thinking about your community. It's thinking about yourself personally. Do you have an extra, set of your prescription medicines ready? Or do you have a bag packed where you could just have some necessities and be able to get somewhere and have things to help until the real official responders come?
Who do you think we should be asking these questions of? You know, obviously the big part of preparedness is thinking about it in advance. Who should we look to? How should we try to look from within?
That is a super question, because I think unless we, the public, sort of demand that our institutions do invest in preparedness, there's sort of almost like not much incentive for them to do so. You know, when a hospital has to decide, or hospital leaders have to decide, do we buy the latest MRI machine or do we invest in hardening our facility against flooding? They may go for the MRI machine unless there are people in the community who are kind of demanding to know, you know, you're in a flood zone. Do you have some protections against that? Or what would, you know, my mom's in a nursing home, what would that nursing home do if they're near one of the rivers in Pittsburgh? So what happens if there's flooding? What's the plan? And I think, you know, it sort of sounds almost outlandish to be knocking on the door of the hospital and asking those questions, but it's not a bad idea, especially if someone you love is in, you know, has home health care or needs access to a dialysis facility or is in a nursing home, to, you know, definitely be asking those questions. Or if you yourself rely on some of these institutions. And the same thing goes for other critical institutions. I write about healthcare, but that's true of schools and other really important community facilities.
Well, and a big part of what happened at Memorial Hospital had to do with that emergency preparedness. You wrote that their 246-page emergency plan offered no guidance for dealing with a complete power failure or how to evacuate the hospital if the streets were flooded, both of which happened during Katrina. I wonder, how have things changed since you first reported this story? Katrina, of course, was in 2005, and only recently lawmakers have required healthcare providers who accept Medicaid and Medicare, so most of them, including small ones like urgent care clinics and nursing homes, to even have that minimum emergency preparedness plan. Is that enough? Are we doing enough?
Well, that remains to be seen. That's a new requirement, and it came out through through our federal government as a rule. So not actually lawmakers, but as a sort of a federal rule that will require, or does now, as of just 2 years ago, require different health providers to have some minimum standards in preparedness. But and that took 12 years before that rule was finalized from when, after Katrina, it was realized that, you know, maybe it makes sense to require health providers to have at least some plans. But a plan on a piece of paper is a little different from actually practicing it. And I think, you know, we all need to think about what kind of muscle memory we need if we're going to face a crisis. So sort of like thinking through it in advance, or drilling it if you're a hospital, for example, having drills is really important. And more broadly, your point about power failures and flooding, I mean, there are a million reasons why the power can fail. And all of us are so dependent on technology. You know, think about when you leave your cell phone somewhere. So I think it's really, really important. What I've noticed, and I've reported all over the world, there are places where they have fewer resources, you know, less advanced technology. And when their technology fails, it's not such a crisis because they're kind of dealing with that all the time. But for us in the U.S., I think our technological advantage can be our Achilles heel when it comes to a time of emergency. And so thinking about, what are our backup plans? Do you have key phone numbers written down on a piece of paper? Or, you know, paper can be a high technology in a disaster. So just thinking through this, and it's very hard as humans to think about worst case scenarios. We don't want to until they happen. But in fact, then when we look back, we say, "Ah, why didn't I think about that? Why didn't I do just a little bit to prepare?" So, you know, being somebody who's covered so many disasters over the years, that's my, you know, big message to the general public, is we all have a stake in this, and we all should spend at least a little time thinking about it.
Sherry Fink is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, New York Times correspondent, and the author of 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death at a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. She speaks at Washington and Jefferson College tonight at the Lecture Hall at Dieter Porter Life Sciences Building. The event starts at 7 p.m. and is free and open to the public. A book sale and signing will follow her talk. Sherry, thanks so much, and thanks for coming to Pittsburgh.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You can find links to that event page at our website at wesa.fm. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, George Vachon was admitted to the bar by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court 132 years after his death. The 2010 decision came more than a century after Vachon was originally denied admission because he was Black. He was born in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and was the first African-American graduate of Oberlin College in Ohio. After his bar attempt in Allegheny County, he went on to take the exam in New York, becoming the first Black lawyer in that state. Throughout his life, he was a powerful abolitionist and advocated for education for all the country's African-American citizens. He died of yellow fever in 1878. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. People who need fitness training and the most help developing healthy habits are often the ones least likely to seek out assistance. That's according to Pittsburgh fitness trainer James Rounds, who tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort that, in addition to operating a private gym, he maintains community-based fitness programs for those who need them most.
We have a for-profit gym downtown, and we just noticed the people that were coming in were not necessarily people that need to be there. So in 2013, we started a nonprofit called 101 Fitness and Training to help go into the community to actually help people that actually needed the help with regards to their health and fitness.
Why was that important to go to where you think your kind of fitness and wellness and nutrition program is needed?
For us, because a lot of people didn't come to us for, you know, being intimidated about a gym setting or just didn't have the knowledge in terms of what they needed. Most people think you have to be in shape to go to a gym, you know, which you can use the gym anytime. But us going out, we felt like that's very important by taking a program to the community.
And you also do it so that it's free, so that there's no stumbling block, no excuse. Just come on out.
Right. Making the program free was another way of taking away some of those barriers to people maintaining their health. So as much as possible, we try to maintain it to where there's no barriers to entry. We invite people to come in as a family. Oftentimes because the moms are usually quick to come, but the husbands are not. But a lot of times the husbands are the ones that's dictating the behavior of the kids. In our community, 33% of us are obese. And within the home, there's 29% of the kids that are obese as well. So we feel like they're developing those habits first, right, in the house.
So what do you do?
We provide health and wellness training and through programming that we do either 60 days, 90 days, or a year in some cases for a community, for different populations, primarily disadvantaged people.
What neighborhoods have you been operating in?
Since we started in 2013, we've operated in the Hill District, primarily in Pittsburgh. Currently, we are in Highland Park area, running a program called Passport to Fitness. In the past, we've also been on the north side, south side, different places throughout the community.
What difference are you making? Is it working? What kind of results do you see?
I think people are averaging about 25 pounds of weight loss, primarily in our programs, but more importantly, our ultimate objective is to change habits, healthy, to create healthy habits. So not only just working out and losing weight, but also understanding how to eat, and also showing people how to substitute foods. Instead of doing like mashed potatoes, we show people how to make cauliflower, ground cauliflower. Tastes just the same, but doesn't have the carb effect. We have some people that have been with us since the beginning, since 2013, and they continue to follow us, you know, in our programs, and that's great. Again, there's a big need out there for what we do. Our ultimate goal is to keep people out of the doctor's office, and some of that work starts at home.
James Rounds, thank you for taking time to do the interview.
Thank you. Appreciate you talking to me.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris in for Kevin Gavin. The fate of the old Civic Arena site has been in limbo for years, since even before the demolition was completed in March 2012. But at long last, the developer presented a plan that passed muster with the city's Urban Redevelopment Authority. 90.5 WESA's Margaret J. Krause has been following this saga closely, and she joins us now. Margaret, good morning.
Good morning, Megan.
So the URA voted Friday on a new plan. I want to get to those particulars, but first, remind us who the players are in this. There's the URA, the Penguins, the city, developers, lots of people representing the Hill District. I know I'm barely scratching the surface here. So who are they all, and what have been their individual concerns?
Well, I think we might actually want to time travel a little bit back to 2007. Which,
let's do it.
Okay, great. I'm not going to fire up the time machine. I wish I could. Maybe I don't. But there is, the Penguins had decided that if they didn't get a new arena, they were going to leave Pittsburgh. They were looking at Kansas City, which was building its own new arena. Mm-hmm. So there was this sense of, we are going to lose a moneymaker for our city. Now, whether or not arenas make money for cities is a totally different question. But then Governor Ed Rendell, then Mayor Luke Ravenstahl, county officials, they all got in a room and with the Penguins and came to a deal. And there were a lot of moving parts, a lot of really sticky particulars that come into our story later. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, they got a new arena. They got exclusive development rights to the land around that arena, and they were given money to buy that land. So it wasn't until much later that residents, business owners, leaders in the Hill were consulted. Which, in terms of who else is involved with all of this, you're right, the URA, the city, the Penguins redevelopment entity, the SEA. But now, the reason the Civic Arena site was where it was in the first place is that during the throes of urban renewal, city officials condemned and cleared 95 acres of land in the Lower Hill, densely populated. And thousands of people were displaced, thousands of businesses, predominantly African-American residents of Pittsburgh.
For our listeners who are new to town, this is where the Penguins played from 1967 to 2011. It's what you probably know as all those unfinished parking lots just north of PPG Paints Arena. And if you've never seen it, those photos are totally worth a Google. Its retractable roof was really a marvel of its day.
Yes, and those parking lots used to be home to just rows and rows of homes and businesses. So the main concern for stakeholders from the Hill District is, all right, you know, there's this deal that we weren't really a part of. We need to ensure that redevelopment brings benefit to the greater Hill District.
And there were some fits and starts to this plan over the last decade. The Penguins asked for extensions to their plans. What were some of the reasons for some of those delays?
It depends on who you ask. Councillor Daniel Lavelle, whose district includes the Hill District, said in a board meeting 2 weeks ago, we got a raw deal, and we've been trying since 2007 to improve it. Kevin Ackland, who's now the vice president and general counsel for the Penguins, will agree and say one of our first actions in office was to try and renegotiate this deal. Residents community groups will tell you, amidst all the negotiations, they were fighting for more opportunities. And then at one point, U.S. Steel in 2014 said, we're going to anchor the development, but then they pulled out because their financials continued to be disappointing.
So this plan that was agreed upon, or at least the beginning of an agreement on Friday, would mean some development this upcoming spring. Assuming everyone stays on board, what will it mean? What is this plan?
Sure. So this is the first of what will likely be 5 or 6 phases of development. So there's a lot left to come. But it concerns 2 parcels and 2 general plans. One is for an entertainment venue, which has retail, room for some entrepreneurs supported by the URA, which is part of this new deal. And parking. And then the other parcel is 288 units of housing, 20% of which may be affordable at 50%, but that depends, and some open space. So those are the two. Buccini Pollen Group is doing the entertainment venue and retail and parking, and Intergen Real Estate is doing the housing.
What portion of this residential component will be designated as affordable? Do we have an idea yet?
Well, so that was part of this new deal that cropped up about 3 weeks ago. And it says in the term sheet, well, it says that it will, the developer team has promised that it will be 20% at 50% AMI. But that depends on getting project-based vouchers from the Housing Authority of the City of Pittsburgh, and that is by no means a guarantee. It's a very competitive process, and they haven't even, the Housing Authority hasn't issued that request yet for applications, and I have not been able to get in touch with anyone over there.
Gotcha. So I understand that the Hill Community Development Corporation pushed for other changes that were not incorporated into the plan. What were they hoping for?
Sure, and a number of other stakeholders, not just the Hill CDC. And those changes, some changes may yet be incorporated. On Friday, when the URA board was examining all of these separate motions, they agreed that there would be a working group that in 30 days will come back and say, okay, based on your letter, the URA can do this, and this is more for the city, this is an SEA obligation, et cetera, et cetera. And so they're hoping that that group can figure out its recommendations before the next Sports and Exhibition Authority board meeting, because they also have to vote. But, sorry, that's process. Forgive me. There are 2 main concerns, process and accountability. So who is at the table when terms are being decided upon, the plan is being agreed upon as things move forward? And then how can the public ensure? Right now, the language is such that the public investment, no matter what happens, it has to be there. Mm-hmm. Whereas what the Penguins entity has promised, it's conditional. It's like, well, if we can't do it, you still have to give us what you promised.
Yeah, and so all they have to do is technically try.
They have to try. And the Penguins have said, we're not messing around. We are here to be a partner. Unfortunately, a lot of people in the Hill have heard that for a long time, and so they're skeptical. They want real assurances, real accountability.
And we should say that this vote on Friday, it just starts or restarts, depending on how you look at it, the whole process. Various parts of the agreement must now go before that Sports and Exhibition Authority, City Council, Allegheny County, the school board. What kinds of permissions will the Penguins need to proceed?
Yes, they need the Sports and Exhibition Authority, which owns the land, some of the land, while the URA owns other parcels. They need the approval on this new change. There has been a suggested change to the what happens to the property tax revenue. Mm-hmm. Originally, it would be half goes to the Greater Hill District Reinvestment Fund, half goes for infrastructure on the Lower Hill into a separate account. Now, the money for the taxes to go to the Greater Hill District Reinvestment Fund would be available upfront, about $40 million. And the developer would just hang on to the other half of that tax revenue. So the SEA needs to approve that, the whole agreement, basically. Mm-hmm. Changes to that tax structure go to all three taxing bodies. And then there's a parking tax diversion, which would allow the Penguins to use their entity, to use the redevelopment of this entertainment parking garage.
Mm-hmm.
That they would use the tax, parking tax, to pay for that.
So clear
they
need, as mud.
Yeah. They need, well, they need, it's less than scintillating, I'll give you that. They need city council to approve a parking tax diversion plan.
And then there's also a review upcoming by the Hill District's Development Review Panel. They'll be making sure that this fits into the neighborhood's existing master plan. Remind us a few of those goals.
Sure. So one of them is to honor and build on the African-American legacy of the Hill. That includes a right of return, so preference for previously displaced people, affordable housing without displacement, homeowner support, green spaces, play spaces, just really helping the Hill to be a strong neighborhood when there's been decades of disinvestment.
And Margaret, you've been following this, I guess, just about as long as you've lived here yourself. What's your next step? What will you be looking for as this plan proceeds?
I mean, I love me a good tax structure agreement, so I'll probably be watching those very closely. I'll be really interested to see how the community continues, not that it's monolithic, different community members and stakeholders work with all these entities to hopefully see what they want to see in the Hill.
Margaret J. Krause is the development and transportation reporter here at WESA. Margaret, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. A federal appeals court Friday held that the city's 15-foot buffer zone around the entrances to women's health clinics is constitutional. But the court did put a new limit on the ordinance, and there may be more controversy to come. 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter is here to dig in. Chris, thanks for making time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So this rule is in place for any clinic that offers abortion services, but it's probably most well known outside Planned Parenthood. That's on Liberty Avenue downtown. Big yellow line traces a semicircle around the front of the double doors. Protesters are often gathered outside it, even across the street. What were these anti-abortion demonstrators allowed to do prior to this ruling?
So basically, as long as you stayed outside of that buffer zone, you could hold your signs, you could pray noisily, you could do what's called sidewalk counseling. And this is sort of a one-on-one thing where somebody who's opposed to abortion kind of sidles up to you as you're on your way into the clinic and says, you know, please don't do this. There are other options, that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. All of that activity up until last week was sort of understood by both the city and the anti-abortion folks and the abortion providers themselves to exclude all of those activities within that zone. What happened last week is the court said, actually, if you look at what's in the ordinance, it doesn't say that there can't be conversations. What the ordinance specifically says is you can't picket, you can't demonstrate, you can't do any of those things that we kind of think of as being big demonstrations. And what it said is because the ordinance doesn't speak to sidewalk counseling, now you can continue that conversation. If you're walking along with somebody, you can continue that conversation past the 15-foot painted line and right up to the door. And what's sort of interesting about this decision is that both sides are sort of hailing it as a victory. And I think we have some clips here both of Sue Fritchie, a lawyer for the Women's Law Center, and Kevin Terrio, who represented the anti-abortion activists.
This was a victory for women's health care providers and for the city of Pittsburgh.
This was a really good ruling for speech, and especially for my clients who want to engage in one-on-one conversation with women in front of abortion clinics.
Chris, what do you make of both sides claiming victory like that?
You don't usually hear those folks agree on much, or rarely are they happy about the same thing. I mean, I think a couple things. One is that clearly the city's law was held to be constitutional in the main. There's always concern these days, especially amongst abortion rights supporters, that that won't happen, that the courts are always just, you know, one vote away from overturning, you know, decades of settled law. So they're happy about that. On the other hand, I think if you are an abortion abortion rights foe, you look at this decision and say, hey, I can do something now today that I couldn't last week. And I think if you look sort of over the broad history of the past 20, 30 years of abortion litigation in this country, this would be another kind of chipping away at an edifice that is generally once really protected abortion access and no longer does to the same extent.
And we should put all of this in context. There's a long history of protective city ordinances getting challenged in court, right? Pittsburgh used to have two kinds of protection for abortion providers.
Yes, they had a buffer zone, which is what we've been talking about here today, the sort of physical barrier around the clinic entrance, and they also had a bubble zone. And a bubble zone was sort of an 8-foot sort of zone of exclusion around people, anybody going into the clinic.
Was it a zone within a zone or a zone outside a zone?
It was the zone outside. It was a zone within 100 feet around the clinic. If you were walking in there, you couldn't be approached.
Okay.
But essentially what happened is, and the reason they did this, we should be clear, is for a long time there were sort of disruptive activities. There was confrontations outside of clinics. The police used to have that people would be shoving each other and things like that. Tempers would get heated. And so there was a lot of problems, especially 15, 20 years ago when the city was really having financial problems. The police just couldn't adjudicate all this stuff. So they tried to set up these zones to kind of reduce that. What happened was about 10 years ago, a federal appeals court judge said, you know what, city, you can have either the buffer zone or the bubble zone, but you can't have both because the two of them combined infringe too much on the freedom of speech, on the speech rights of the protesters. So the city kind of decided, well, we got to get rid of them, and they got rid of the bubble zone. And they did that because it was harder to police. It's harder to have a 8-foot floating exclusion zone around individual people. The problem for the city was it was only the bubble zone that included this language, like you can't approach somebody if they don't want to be approached. That wasn't in the buffer zone exclusion. And so that's what the court found and why we're where we are today.
Well, regarding this ruling that was issued on Friday, is there confusion about what that means? It sounds like this goes back quite a ways. What if a counselor continues to talk? What does it mean to have activity within that zone?
Yeah, so anything like you couldn't hold a sign, for example, you couldn't do that kind of stuff. That would be picketing. That would be demonstrating, which is still barred under this ordinance, and all that still stands. You could, as I read the ruling, as I understand from talking to the lawyers, you don't necessarily have to be welcomed as long as you are, you know, calm and not disruptive. Basically, now people going into this clinic, it seems, will just kind of have to deal with you right up until they get to the door and go in.
What about literature? Can they hand that out, or is there any restriction as to what the literature can say or show?
To the best of my knowledge, there is not. Nothing in the ruling speaks to that. Of course, a person would have the ability to decline to accept literature the same you would from any kind of street corner preacher or any of the other characters you find downtown, but there's nothing to prevent them from offering it to you.
When we hear the word protest, it can sometimes sound like it might be a little bit more of a combative back and forth. Is that something that is covered at all during this ruling? What would constitute, you know, a considerate exchange of ideas?
Yeah, there's not too much. I mean, mostly what the ruling really focuses on is sort of the volume, not having too many people come into the 15-foot zone. But this does raise sort of an interesting question, which Sue Fritchie, the first of the voices we heard about, spoke to as well, which is we have this ruling, it's about 38 pages, but how it's going to play out on the ground is something we have yet to see.
There is a question about how this decision is going to play out on the street. And there's a footnote in this decision that says, we recognize the city has a legitimate concern about access to healthcare facilities. If you are calm and peaceful and engaged in one-on-one conversation, then you can do it. But I am skeptical about whether the kind of protesters who we typically see can conform their conduct to those very significant restraints.
Yeah, so I think what you hear there is somebody who's been spending 20, 25 years of her life kind of adjudicating just these issues, and this real sense of a wall has been kind of punctured here, and we don't know yet what it means.
So technically, this decision affirms a lower court ruling that said that the city ordinance is sound. That said, it doesn't sound like it means precisely what abortion access supporters maybe thought it did to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question, right? Is now everything sort of depends on how these sidewalk counselors, as they style themselves, are going to conduct themselves. But yeah, I mean, again, it's better if you're an abortion rights supporter than having the ordinance stricken down entirely.
How have other stakeholders been reacting to the court decision?
Yeah, I mean, the anti-abortion folks are happy that they will be able to do this stuff that they have previously been barred from. There's some complaining on their part that it's a little confusing now. You know, some of us will have to act in such a way on one side of the line, whereas if we cross the line, we'll be able to do other kind of stuff. There is some talk that there may be an appeal here on that side, depending. And of course, this is abortion law. There's always contention locally and across the national scale, too.
What about Planned Parenthood itself? As we say, it's got probably one of the most noticeable buffer zones in the city.
Yeah, they are very excited about the ruling. At least it's Kim Evert, who heads up the organization here in Western Pennsylvania, said they were very enthusiastic about it because it did leave the ordinance standing in the main.
And the Peduto administration?
Yeah. Also, this is a law that passed before Mr. Peduto was mayor, but while he was still city councilor, he voted for it. They have defended it since then, and they are also sort of emphasizing the positive, as it were.
You've reported with our colleague Lucy Perkins that who ruled on this case is important as well. What did the judges themselves tell us about the case?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is for as much as contentious as abortion law can be, this was a more or less unanimous ruling. The decision was authored by an Obama appointee. It was concurred by a Reagan appointee. But perhaps most significantly, there was a concurring opinion written by Tom Hardiman. Should be a familiar name to folks because he was kind of the number two, the runner-up to replace Anthony Kennedy last year, and it was Brett Kavanaugh who actually got that spot. But Hardiman wrote a concurring opinion, which is kind of like a bear hug. He's sort of, oh, this is a good opinion, but he makes very clear that the city needs to be careful, that just because these sidewalk counselors talk with love and compassion, or at least that's what they claim, there's nothing now that if they decide to get more aggressive in terms of what they say, the city can't do anything about it.
And the lawyer who represented the clients had a little bit more to say about that.
Judge Hardiman was careful to say to the city, look, you have to be very careful on how you are enforcing this ordinance, even though we've reinterpreted it. If you are enforcing the ordinance in a way that, for instance, treats Planned Parenthood escorts differently than it treats the pro-life counselors that we represent, that could be problematic.
Yeah, and there you have it. If there's already the seeds for a future dispute may be being sown here. And there is a broader, as I said before, there's a broader sort of national context. There is before the Supreme Court right now a case involving a bubble zone in Chicago. And that may redefine, even though it's a different kind of zone than the one that we have here, you never can tell what the Supreme Court is going to do with this stuff. So we may see changes even down the road. This litigation could easily continue or come back under another case.
So what comes next? Oftentimes when a court ruling is issued, the side that comes out on the short end appeals. But with both sides expressing various degrees of acceptance, does that diminish the chance of an appeal up to the Supreme Court level?
Yeah, I think the city and Planned Parenthood are clearly content with the situation as it is. If there is a movement for an appeal, it will come, I suspect, from the abortion rights supporters. They've kind of got the hot hand here. I mean, this case has come before. It's kind of got bounced back and forth between the local districts, federal court, and then the Federal Court of Appeals, I think three times now. And every time what's happened is the local judge, Kathy Bassoon, has basically ruled in favor of the city, on the side of the city, on the side of the abortion providers. And then what's happened is these folks have gone to the appeals court and gotten a reversal, and then it goes back, and then it comes back. So in a way, what's the harm from their perspective? What's the harm in continuing to push this? But as I say, there are other cases also pending for the Supreme Court. So who knows? A year from now, all of this stuff could be moot.
And of course, as we mentioned, our dear colleague Lucy Perkins has explored the history of abortion access here in Pittsburgh. You can find those stories on our website at WESA.FM. Chris, how will you and your team be following this in the days ahead?
Well, you know, as I say, I mean, we'll look certainly to see if there's any motion here. But the big question, I think, really right now is at the federal Supreme Court level here. It's not just about abortion access. The court is also handling a case out of Louisiana, which basically requires requires an abortion provider to have admitting privileges at a hospital.
And those are cases we've seen across the country in various levels of the court system.
Yeah. And in fact, the Supreme Court itself ruled against that requirement just a few years ago, but now it's back. And the fact that the court has taken up a case so soon after deciding a similar one to it, I think, is a lot of people anxious, because now Brett Kavanaugh is on the court. And I think a lot of people are worried about what that means for Roe and for abortion rights in general.
We'll have to leave it there. Chris Potter is WESA's government and accountability editor. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, new research shows that 1 in 6 young people ages 10 to 17 in Pennsylvania is obese, and that's well above the national average. We'll discuss what's being done in our region to reduce those numbers and help children lead healthier lives. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Julia Zankovich. I am the editor and producer of The Confluence. I'm Megan Harris. Kevin Gavin will be back with you tomorrow. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.